The Deltons have known what to do with it, so Archimedes isn't unique. Marvin looked around at us to make sure we would get his next comment. I think there's a recessive gene for increased intelligence that's spreading through the population. It just needs the opportunity to be expressed in every sense of the word. I nodded. Let's give them that chance. Take a couple of drones, pick up some flint, and we'll drop it in the area where Archimedes normally hangs out. Let's see what happens. There was a lot of wailing and growling when the hunting parties came back to camp that evening. The Deltons obviously understood death. We didn't know yet how they handled their dead since the gorilloids had taken the bodies. One of the hunters seemed especially broken up and was curled up on the ground shaking. I checked the records and, yep, he spent a lot of his downtime with one of the Deltons that had been killed. Yeah, I'm definitely getting personally involved. Sue me. I decided right there and then that I didn't like the gorilloids. I've got something for you, Marvin said, interrupting my thoughts. I looked up at the schematic floating in my holotank. It showed plans for an observation drone that had been reinforced internally and given 20-pound steel caps at each end. A sort of personnel buster. Even with the modest acceleration capabilities of the drones, they could probably deliver a punch equivalent to a cannonball. Whether the drone would survive was an unknown. I guess railguns weren't an option? I asked. No! Even ignoring the complexity of the loading system, the surge drive in the drones just can't support enough acceleration to make a small-caliber missile dangerous. I sighed, and for the umpteenth time wondered if I should reconsider my policy on explosives. And for the umpteenth time, I decided not to. I can produce a dozen of these in a few days if we bump all the other stuff, Marvin added. It's not an ideal solution, but it is a quick one to implement. As Senior Bob, decisions about manufacturing priorities were up to me. I thought about it for a few milliseconds, then nodded my head. We weren't on a schedule for launching Heaven vessels, so screw it. I wasn't going to let even one more Deltan get killed by the gorilloids if I could help it. It took Archimedes a couple of days to find the flint. We had dropped the nodules where we figured he'd happen upon them, but it's not as if he had a regular route. He wandered like any normal kid and was just as likely to walk in circles or sit on a rock for half a day playing with something. As soon as Archimedes saw the nodules, he jumped forward and picked them up. He then put them down, did a little jig, and searched the immediate area for any more. When he was satisfied that he had found all there were to find, he came back, grabbed them, and headed back toward his camp. He got maybe 50 feet, then stopped and looked down at his load. Marvin and I glanced at each other, perplexed. After a few moments, Archimedes headed off at an angle toward an outcropping that was one of his favorite hangouts. Once there, he hid all of the nodules except one in a crevice, then covered it with dead branches. Eden, you said? I laughed. Looks like we've invented greed. Marvin grinned. Or caution. I bet Flint is valuable. He might be worried about being mugged. Taking a single flint nodule, Archimedes walked back to camp and took a circuitous route to get to his mother. When he arrived, he set up with a couple of rocks to try to split the flint. We chuckled at the deliberate, studied casualness that he was trying to affect. It was so overdone that he might as well have been wearing a hat with a flashing red light. Before he'd even struck the first blow, several adult Deltans had come over. There was a loud exchange, and one of the adults tried to grab the nodule. Archimedes' mother jumped in, and the discussion got heated. Within seconds, a dozen or so Deltans were involved. At least half of them were yelling at any time, and pointy sticks were being waved. However, the floor seemed to be about evenly divided between those who wanted to take the nodule and those who suggested it would be over someone's dead body. Archimedes huddled at his mother's feet while she showed her teeth to anyone who got too close. Finally, things calmed down. Deltans stood around eyeing each other while another individual was fetched. I could see that he was older. It looked like age was age, whatever planet you lived on. His fur was going gray, and he was stooped. His muscle tone was poor, so he moved slowly. Another point for these people, they care for their elderly. The elder unwrapped some tools from a leather skin, sat with Archimedes, and patiently showed him how to split the flint. Now that was interesting. There was existing flint technology that hadn't been lost. this contraction of Deltan populations had to have been quick and recent. Many of the Deltans who had been involved in the yelling match went running off. They soon came back with items such as extra pointy sticks, dead animals and chunks of meat, something that looked like some kind of tuber, and other less identifiable things. With a start, I realized they were prepared to trade for the flint. I put both hands to my face and started to laugh. We'd just made Archimedes rich. The trading frenzy was over, and people had left with flints of various sizes. Archimedes' mother was going over the spoils. She had an expression involving wide eyes and erect ears that I tentatively identified as a smile analog. Looks like they'll be eating well for a few days. Archimedes had a haul of his own. He'd gotten several pointy sticks, a flint knife that had lost its edge, and all the flint flakes that were too small to be usable. Most importantly, the elder had shown him how to nap the flint. I watched him examine his treasures, and I could just hear the gears turning. Archimedes spent most of the rest of the day trying to put a new edge on the flint knife he'd received in trade. From the look of it, he didn't do a half-bad job. The kid was a quick learner, for sure. He took his prize to the elder, who I decided to name Moses for no good reason that I could think of. Moses looked at the result and nodded in approval. Okay, he actually did kind of a circle thing with his head, but it had the same meaning. He spent an hour showing Archimedes how to get the last bits sharpened. The next day, Archimedes snuck out to his stash and pulled out one of the other flint nodules. He had the napping tools that the elder had given him. He turned the nodule over and examined it for almost a half hour without actually doing anything with it. It was pretty obvious that he had something in mind and didn't want to screw it up. I watched with great interest, and I sensed Marvin watching over my shoulder, VR-wise. Finally, Archimedes got to work. It took maybe 10 minutes before we could see what he was trying for. He had split the nodule left of center, then right of center on the bigger half. He was trying to extract the biggest flake he could. I decided he was probably going for a hand axe. Over the next several hours, Archimedes slowly and deliberately converted the large core into a quite workable hand axe. He then cleaned up his area, carefully hiding all the useful flint pieces in his stash, and headed off with his new tool. It turned out the point of the axe was to cut more saplings for pointy sticks. It made sense once I thought about it. Green wood, or whatever this stuff was, wouldn't be easy to cut without something hard and sharp. It was beginning to look like the loss of their flint source had been a major blow for the Deltans, perhaps one they hadn't thought about at the time, or they would have protected that site more aggressively. While cutting the third sapling, Archimedes had a misfire and attempted to chop the tree with his hand instead of the axe. The hopping around and verbalizations were really very human-looking, and to my shame, I laughed a little. Afterward, Archimedes kicked the tree and said something monosyllabic. I marked that as an F-bomb analog, and I don't mean maybe. Archimedes finished cutting down the third sapling, but I could see that his heart wasn't in it. His swings were tentative, and he hesitated on each one. As soon as he had it down, he took the three saplings back to his work area, set them down, and went back to camp. The next day he was back in his work area. He had brought some of his twine with him. I watched in fascination and mounting excitement as he proceeded to split one of the saplings and tie the hand axe into it. Once he was done, he tried it out on a nearby tree. The first attempt was spectacularly unsuccessful. The axe acted like one of those tennis ball launchers you buy to throw a ball for your dog, with the axe blade playing the part of a tennis ball. Archimedes threw the now empty stick down, reinforced my conclusion about the F-bomb analog, and stomped off to look for his blade. I took a few moments to check with the Autofactory AMIs. There were no problems on that front. The vessels for Marvin, Luke, and Bender were almost complete. I felt a moment of anxiety. It was great having company, especially given the nature of our shared project. I half hoped one or more of them would decide to hang around instead of taking off for the stars. Archimedes had found the tennis ball, hand axe, and was reattaching it to the stick, grumbling away in Deltan. I carefully cataloged the monologue. Very likely there were a lot of scatological and sexual references in there, and learning to swear in any language is always interesting. His second attempt was better. in that the axe blade didn't take off for parts unknown. But the stick had been intended for a spear, well, a pointy stick, and was too thin to serve as an axe handle. It bounced, rebounded, and twisted in his hand with every swing. Muttering darkly, Archimedes lay down the hand axe and stalked off. He came back in a few minutes with a more robust handle, sat down, and went through the whole mounting sequence. This time when he tried it, the axe produced a very gratifying thunk, and wood chips flew. Archimedes gave a whoop that needed no translation and finished cutting down the sapling. He spent the rest of the afternoon gathering suitable specimens. I noticed that his selections were considerably straighter than most of the weapons used by the Deltans, and I wondered if this was because of greater discernment on his part, or if they'd simply been making do with what they could find. In any case, Archimedes' return to the camp caused a near riot. Interestingly, Archimedes took a couple of token items in exchange, but mostly just gave away the pointy sticks to the biggest Deltans. This not only placed them in his debt, but also ensured that the gorilloids would be given the warmest welcome possible on their next visit. Damn, that kid is smart. I jumped a little. I'd been so wrapped up in what Archimedes was doing that I'd forgotten all about Marvin. Yeah, he's going to own the place by the time he's full grown, I said, and hopefully he'll have lots of opportunity to spread his genes. I can't say that I looked forward to the next gorilloid attack, but I did look forward to the gorilloids maybe getting their asses kicked. I noticed over the next week that the Deltans seemed to be eating better. Better cutting tools meant more tubers with less work, and better pointy sticks meant better hunting results. The Deltans seemed to particularly favor something that I would consider a large wild pig analog with the same general feeding habits and sunny disposition. It took a half dozen Deltans to bring one down, but the carcass would feed 20 or so Deltans for several days. Good return on effort. Part of their strategy involved bracing the butt of the pointy stick against the ground or a rock or tree and letting the charging pigoid impale itself. Since the pigoids never seemed to learn, it was a dependable source of food. The new, straighter pointy sticks did a much better job and resulted in dinner with less effort overall. Meanwhile, Archimedes had risen significantly in stature. He and his mother were now closer to the campfire, and the other juveniles were deferring to him. In fact, since Archimedes seemed to be pretty close to puberty, from what I could tell, some of the female juveniles were giving him a whole lot of attention. Way to go, kid. Then came the day I'd been both looking forward to and dreading, another gorilloid attack. By now, Archimedes had armed everyone with the good pointy sticks, and the improved hunting prospects meant more adult males stayed home to guard. A small group of gorilloids appeared out of nowhere and attacked Group E. The Deltan females and cubs scattered, and the gorilloids seemed to somehow agree on a couple of specific victims to concentrate on. The gorilloids chased their chosen prey in groups of three. I noted in passing that they had chosen adult females rather than cubs, maybe because the cubs were quicker or perhaps because they provided less meat. One of the female targets ran right through a pack of approaching males with the gorilloids hot on her heels. The Deltans stopped, rammed the butts of their pointy sticks in the ground, and stood fast with as much courage as any medieval pikeman facing a cavalry charge. The effect was every bit as dramatic as I could have hoped for. The two leading gorilloids each took a couple or three sticks right in the chest. They were lifted into the air as their momentum converted to leverage on the sticks. As they hung suspended in the air for a moment, the gorilloids let out ear-piercing screams of agony. They came down to earth as their momentum reversed and fell over, still screaming. Although their huge arms still made them dangerous, the gorilloids were obviously badly wounded and couldn't get up. The Deltans fell upon them with pointy sticks, and within seconds, the screaming had stopped. The third gorilloid of the group got a rush of common sense to the head and made for the trees. The other group of three gorilloids had caught their intended victim but stopped when their compatriots started to scream. Now the Deltans, flush with their victory, rushed headlong toward the second group of gorilloids, yelling what were probably battle cries. The gorilloids were momentarily frozen with beastly astonishment, but finally managed to figure out that something was different. Dropping their victim, they sprinted for the forest, empty-handed, in full rout. The Deltons followed them to the edge of the camp, screaming and yelling. Again, I made careful note of the verbalizations. Pretty sure there were variations of "your mama" in there. The first official English Delton dictionary would not be suitable for all ages if I had a say in it. One of the Deltons, in an excess of zeal, hauled off and threw his pointy stick at the fleeing gorilloids. In one of those moments that changed the universe forever, the stick flew a trajectory that would make an Olympic decathlete proud and buried itself in the back of the neck of one of the targets. The animal fell over like it had been pole-axed and skidded face down to a full stop. The other two didn't even miss a step. The Delton Defense Force fell silent, and I discovered that slack-jawed amazement was probably a universal expression. A dozen Deltons stared at the dead gorilloid for several beats. Then a dozen Delton heads turned as one to stare at the spear chucker. Oh, please shrug. Oh, please let a shrug be in their repertoire. No such luck. I cataloged the ear movement as a probable shrug analog, swallowed my disappointment, and watched as the Deltons moved as a group toward the downed gorilloid. What did I miss? Marvin said as he appeared beside me. Just watch the replay. You will not believe this. The Delton spear chucker pulled his pointy stick from the dead gorilloid and poked it a few times. Getting no reaction, he turned to his friends and grinned. Not literally, of course, but I was getting used to interpreting the Delton expressions in human terms. They all started talking at once, jabbing the carcass and slapping and hugging each other. After a few minutes, they picked up the carcass and carried it back to camp. Well, fair's fair, Marvin observed. I laughed. Now that's payback. The Deltons ate well for the next few days, and gorilloids could be converted into many useful items, from hide strips to bone tools. The spear-chucking story was the hit of the campground. Deltons were just as prone as humans to act things out, and every retelling had a rapt audience. The spear-chucker got the lion's share of the gorilloid that he'd taken down, and an apparent large bump in status. He looked tired, but very happy. Archimedes was fascinated by the story as well. Anytime he saw or heard a retelling, he would run over to join the audience. Like many of the Deltons, he began to experiment with this technological innovation. The Deltons already understood throwing, but it seemed they'd never considered applying it to anything other than rocks. It was getting quite dangerous around the camp, until some of the elders put their collective foot down. After much yelling and gesturing, the experimenters took their sticks outside the camp to practice. Unfortunately, even very straight, pointy sticks didn't fly dependably true. The spear chucker really had been lucky. Very few spears actually stuck into anything when thrown, and some of the Deltons had already given it up as a fad. Archimedes wasn't having any better luck with his spear chucking, but unlike the others, he took his pointy stick, sat down, and stared at it. I knew that look. I'd worn that look many times. He was working it out. It only took a few hours for Archimedes to find a flake about the right size, split the end of the pointy stick, and tie the flake onto it. The difference in weight wasn't much, but it moved the center of gravity forward of the grip point. That was all that was needed. The next time Archimedes threw the stick, it embedded itself in the ground in a most satisfactory manner. The other experimenters watched as Archimedes repeated the result twice more. After the third toss, one of the adults grabbed the spear and examined it. This resulted in another raucous town hall meeting. After Archimedes got his spear back, there was some further discussion. Then Archimedes headed off toward his cache with half the encampment following him. By this point, I was grinning like a fool. You go, boy. There was a lot more gabbling when Archimedes brought out his two remaining flint nodules. I think some people were angry with him for holding out. There was some pushing and shoving, and I readied the drone to bash some heads if necessary. We hadn't deployed the Buster drones yet, but I was quite prepared to sacrifice one of the light-duty units. I was certain that it would only take one to clear the room. Fortunately, it wasn't necessary. The Deltans that Archimedes had given the first good pointy sticks to, the largest members of the tribe, were firmly on his side, and the others seemed understandably reluctant to challenge them. One of the support group was a particularly impressive specimen that I had named Arnold. When Arnold leaned over an opponent and started yelling, there was generally very little further debate. Arnold made a gesture and said something that included "get" and the name that the Deltans used for Moses. Several Deltans ran off, and a few minutes later Moses was escorted over. It looked like he was being hustled along a bit more quickly than he really found comfortable. I could pick up a few words, and I'm pretty sure Moses compared the members of his escort to pigoid droppings. Smelly ones. To the extent I was able to follow the discussion, it sounded like Archimedes would volunteer his nodules to make spear points for everyone, and in return, he would get part of every kill from then on. Moses said something in an angry tone, and the agreement was amended to include him. I'm positive that I heard a comment to the effect that that wouldn't be for long anyway. Moses looked offended, but seemed otherwise satisfied. He and Archimedes set to work on the nodules, with half the camp watching.
36. Riker, September 2158, Sol. I leaned back, my jaw dropping as I watched the debate descend yet again into a yelling match. We now had 42 distinct groups willing to maintain contact with us. Not all of them had bought into the emigration idea. Some were keeping their options open, and some just didn't want to be left out of the loop. But they all had two things in common. They didn't trust each other, and they didn't trust us. At the moment, we were dealing with the Spitsbergen Refuge. Technically, they were part of the USE, but as they didn't recognize Colonel Butterworth's authority, that wasn't getting us any mileage. The issue at front and center right now was the Svalbard Global Trust. The existence of the vaults and their value for colonists had circulated quickly, probably thanks to the Spitsbergen group. Now, Walter was playing his trump card. He was demanding to be at the top of the colonization list, or no one would be getting the contents of the vaults. But Butterworth's group would fill both ships, and he was adamantly unwilling to give up all or part of a ship, or leave part of his group behind. We'd circled around several times, always returning to the same arguments and rebuttals, and I was seriously considering assigning Guppy to cover for me. Some of the other groups were suggesting we just go in and take it by force, or just wait until the Spitz died out. Colonel Butterworth looked like he approved, but I wasn't prepared to go there. Finally, I'd had enough. I leaned forward and said, in a loud voice, "Mr. Walter." Argument cut off and all heads turned to me. "I think we've established by now that your demand to be on the first ship out is not going to fly. You may think you can just dig in and wait for us to cave to your demands, but the other alternative is for us to just walk in and take what we want." This got me a surprised look from the colonel, swiftly replaced by a very convincing poker face. The colonel knew that was a bluff. "Unfortunately, so did Mr. Walter."
"Sorry, no, Mr. Riker. I am willing to call your bluff. Nor would you achieve your goals. We have already taken steps, what you would call a scorched earth policy, to ensure that you would achieve nothing."
I nodded. And maybe that would work, and maybe it wouldn't. And maybe we'll still find another of the repositories in one piece, and maybe we won't. But two things we know for sure. One, you're not going to get the first ship. And two, if you persist in this stance and force our hand, you won't be on a ship at all, first, last, or otherwise. You think about that for a while, Mr. Walter. I'm done for today. And with that, I turned off my video feed. Within 2 minutes, I had a dozen requests for private conversations. None, unfortunately, from Walter. I started with the call from Butterworth.
"Very nice performance, Riker, but probably not effective unless you are willing to follow through.
Colonel, if the Spitz endanger everyone else by refusing access to the vaults, or worse, by destroying them, then I'm fine with leaving them behind. The comment about an assault, I'm not quite there yet." He sat back in his chair and nodded.
"I am, of course, adamant about not giving up the first two ships. I'm gratified that we're on the same wavelength. even if for different reasons.
I'm sorry if I'm being abrupt, Colonel, but I've got a dozen calls on hold. Did you have something you wanted to bring up? The Colonel nodded.
I did some thinking, and some back-of-the-napkin calculations. The third ship, with only a small change in schedules, you could advance completion by a year. Perhaps that would be enough for the Spitz.
I stared at Colonel Butterworth in astonishment. It was a good idea, but since it involved delaying the first two ships by almost 4 months to compensate, I would have expected the Colonel to go ballistic at the thought. The fact that he was suggesting it was totally unexpected. Thanks, Colonel. I'll keep that in mind for the next round of hell. I signed off with the Colonel and picked the next call in order. It was from the Faith Enclave. I'd had several harsh exchanges with them by now because they still expected me to give them priority.
Good morning, Minister Cranston. What can I do for you?
Good morning. I've been following the argument with the Spitsbergen group. I note, in passing, that a ship carrying them would have enough space to spare for almost all of our group. It seems to me to be a good synergy. I think you should consider it.
Almost all of your group. And what would happen to the balance, Minister?
Hard times require sacrifices, Replicant.
Riker. He nodded in acknowledgement, an amused smile on his face.
I understand your need to think of yourself as still human. Nevertheless, you are not. You are Faith property. And on that subject, protocol override 4 Alpha 23.
I stared at him in confusion for a few moments before my memory caught up with the conversation. Among the many repairs that Bob One had done to our matrix on the way to Epsilon Eridani, he'd removed a few buried imperatives installed by Faith programmers. That particular code phrase was supposed to activate one of them, which would make me into a good, obedient puppet. I was paralyzed for several milliseconds by competing and conflicting thoughts and emotions, amusement, rage, an urge to laugh at him, and another to nuke him. I decided to go with minimalism.
Minister Cranston?
Yes, Replicant?
Go fuck yourself.
I terminated the call and examined the next in queue. I had finally made it through the queue. All of the calls were variations on themes that I'd already dealt with several times. Requests for special treatment, attempts to negotiate favorable positions, appeals to sympathy, those were the hardest to deal with. And in a couple of occasions, attempts at out-and-out bribery. I realized that there was one more call waiting, apparently a late entrance. And it was from Valter. Well, this could be good or bad, but either way, it's going to be interesting. I opened the channel.
Good day, Mr. Valter. What's shaking?
Valter looked surprised, but recovered quickly.
Ah, I'm not so easily thrown off, Mr. Riker. In any case, unnecessary. A little bird told me that there is some movement possible in the scheduling of the third ship. If the departure dates were close enough together, I think that there could be room for discussion.
Finally, thank you, Colonel. There was really very little doubt about who the little bird had been speaking for.
Well then, Mr. Valter, let's see what we can come up with.
37. Bob, August 2165, Delta Eridani. It had been a few weeks since the last gorilloid attack, and both the Deltans and I had relaxed. I had some hope that the beating the Deltans had handed out might have sent a clear enough message. I imagine the Deltans felt the same. No such luck. I didn't know if the gorilloids had enough smarts to formulate a plan or if it was just coincidence, but on this particular day, the gorilloids launched the largest offensive I'd ever seen. Or maybe it was just the smell of all that meat being cooked. The spears had made the Deltans even more successful at hunting, and I was beginning to wonder if they had enough sense not to depopulate their hunting area. If they were outcompeting the gorilloids for food, then maybe the gorilloids were feeling the pinch. In any case, I looked on in dismay as 31 gorilloids descended on the encampment. I called the others immediately. Luke was on a shakedown cruise, and lightspeed lag would make him ineffective for assistance, but Marvin and Bender showed up immediately. We cranked our frame rates up to maximum to have time to discuss the situation. The VR faded out as the core adjusted to the increased demand.
What the hell? How did this happen?
Marvin asked. I shrugged. I think the gorilloids are hungry and a little desperate. I don't think we have to read anything more than that into it.
Bender jumped in. Have you guys deployed the Buster drones yet?
Geez, no,
I scowled, a feeling of self-loathing washing over me. Things had been going well, and I just figured we had all the time in the world. Guppy, how long to get them there?
10 minutes, plus or minus 2. Atmospheric entry is the limiting factor and a source of largest uncertainty.
Launch them, now.
Done.
It would only take a few minutes for the drones to get from our position in orbit to the upper atmosphere, but if I didn't want them to burn up, they'd have to take a more sedate pace to descend to the colony. Marvin interrupted my introspection.
We can't sacrifice our observation drones without a good reason, especially since they don't have the legs to get up a real head of steam.
True, I replied. Let's set them near Archimedes. I think we have to be most concerned about protecting him.
We discussed the situation for a few more milliseconds, but there were really not a lot of options open.
With a sigh, I adjusted my frame rate back to real time. The VR faded in, but I didn't care. The Deltans outnumbered the gorilloids by a significant margin, but the gorilloids were the stereotypical 800-pound gorillas. They went where they wanted and did what they wanted. It took a half dozen Deltans with spears to hold one off. The Deltans were giving a good account of themselves, but the gorilloids just kept coming. Not only that, but they didn't seem to be happy with one Deltan for a half dozen gorilloids. Either they were really starving, or there was some aspect of vengeance involved. A group of gorilloids had attacked Group C and were beating their way through the defenders toward the women and children. Several of them started to break through the defensive line. The women and children tried to back away from the gorilloids, but they had nowhere to go. Archimedes was in the middle of the pack trying to hide behind his mother. I could see him shaking in fear, and I felt myself curling and uncurling my fists. As one of the gorilloids made a break for the group, Arnold came out of nowhere and stuck a spear right through his back. And that right there is what spear points are good for. I let out a breath and relaxed. Too soon. Arnold tried to retrieve his spear, but dislodging it would take more time than he had available. With a roar, another gorilloid charged him. Arnold managed to throw himself at the gorilloid's legs, which tripped up the animal and allowed Arnold to roll away, but the gorilloid was unharmed and already getting up. Arnold looked around, but there was nothing usable as a weapon within reach. As the gorilloid snarled and locked its gaze on Arnold, Archimedes yelled and tossed him the axe. Arnold caught it and swung it down onto the middle of the gorilloid's head just as it came into range. There was a loud crack, and the gorilloid dropped like a marionette whose strings had been cut. Arnold looked at the axe in his hand for a few moments. Slack-jawed amazement. Yep. Then with a roar, he began to lay into gorilloids. Conan the Barbarian would have been proud. Arnold was an impressive specimen of Deltan, almost big enough to pass as a juvenile gorilloid, and the hand axe was about equivalent to a felling axe. Archimedes had been trying for the biggest he could make, and he'd been very successful. Within moments, Arnold had split several more gorilloid skulls. This was a new battle tactic with no real natural equivalent, so the gorilloids simply had no defense for it. The other Deltan males rallied, and in a few more seconds, Group C was cleared of attackers. Arnold and the surviving males headed off to the groups on either side to reinforce the defenders. Then, disaster. One of the gorilloids executed a successful feint and found itself inside the line of defenders with nothing between itself and the women and children, and Archimedes stood right there, unarmed, frozen in place. His mother was screaming. I could see Arnold turning, seemingly in slow motion. For a moment, I thought I might be in frame jack, but no, I was simply in shock.
Guppy, Buster, status now.
Coming up, handing over lead unit. Now.
Abandoning any shred of VR simulation, I jacked up my frame rate and slipped into the Buster. I could see the battle coming up through my forward camera, and I picked out the gorilloid. Archimedes was just starting to back away, and his mother was running to him. Arnold was pushing himself toward the attacker. I got there first. 40 pounds of high-tensile steel intersected the gorilloid at twice the speed of a bullet from a high-powered rifle. The impact was not merely fatal. Hydrostatic shock tore the gorilloid apart almost cell by cell and spread it evenly over the surrounding ground. Deltons, trees, gorilloids, and anything else in range. The sonic boom reverberated like thunder from a lightning bolt directly overhead. Every living thing in the area froze and crouched in fear. The Deltons recovered first. Unknown noise or not, they had loved ones to protect. Several gorilloids went down before they could recover their senses. The quick deaths turned the tide, and the gorilloids turned tail and fled. A couple of dozen thrown spears followed them, and 8 more gorilloids went down before they could reach the trees. It was over. The carnage was unbelievable. The gorilloids had been as much on a mission of destruction as they were on a hunt. Perhaps they'd been killing Deltons with the intent of collecting the bodies afterward. Perhaps they were just in some kind of feeding frenzy brought on by hunger. I realized how little I knew about the biology on this planet. I wasn't a professional biologist. I was a dilettante playing at biologist. A fake one at that. And I might have caused a situation that made things worse. The Delton toll was 30 dead with another 15 or so injured, some severely enough that they probably wouldn't survive. I gritted my teeth. Prime directive, my ass. I'm going on a gorilloid hunt. I directed the observation drone to a different location, closer to Archimedes. He was examining the area where the gorilloid had been. There were a few pieces of gorilloid still there, but a lot of the momentum of the buster had transferred to the animal and most of the detritus was down track. It took him only moments to notice that, and he started following the trail. Hey, Guppy? Anything left of the buster?
No information available. No telemetry.
Yeah, that's what I'm worried about. Marvin tapped the video image with a finger.
The kid is going to find wreckage if there's anything left. Question is, should we be worried?
Fair enough. They don't have any metallurgy at all, and our stuff is all going to have a very high melting point. They won't be able to work it.
We watched as Archimedes worked his way along the trail. He soon came to a deep furrow in the ground. When he reached the end of the furrow, the ground was mounded up. Archimedes stared at the scene for a few minutes, then took off at a run. He came back within a minute with a piece of what I supposed could be called bark in a scoop shape. I recognized it as a shared tool that was often used for digging up tubers.
"He'll be at that a few minutes, I think," Marvin said.
We switched to another drone and watched Arnold. He was demonstrating the use of the hand axe in battle to the males. Fortunately, not actually on anyone. The other males paid rapt attention.
"They're going to want to make more axes."
I nodded. "Archimedes is out of nodules. They've thoroughly searched the area where we dropped the first set. We couldn't get away with dropping off any more."
"Maybe we shouldn't do anything."
Marvin had a thoughtful look. I looked at him sideways.
"Okay, why?"
"If they have any memory of where their flint source used to be, and with Moses still alive, that's possible, then it might be a good thing for them to go back there."
"Oh, goody," I said, smacking my forehead. "A quest! Will there be 9 of them? They can stop in Rivendell."
Marvin rolled his eyes.
"Okay, Captain Sarcasm, but seriously, this location isn't ideal for a lot of reasons. They ended up here because they kept retreating without a plan. Luke and I pretty much established that. The flint site is more defensible than this one, has better access to fresh water, and has flint."
I sighed and rubbed my forehead. A part of me still gets some amusement out of that virtual action, but habits like that kept me feeling like I was still human, and it felt good. "Guppy, get Bender and Luke on the horn, please."
"Working. There will be a 0.75-second round-trip delay."
"Noted. Tell everyone to crank the frame rate down to 1/4 to mask it." I waited for a few seconds, then Bender and Luke appeared on the screen. "Hey, guys," I began. "I guess it's time to talk about plans. You've both passed your shakedowns, so all 3 of you are ready and able to pick a destination and take off. On the other hand, we have a race of sentience here, which we all know is an irresistible project. So, thoughts?"
"Honestly," Bender replied, "the Delton thing isn't so much of an attraction for me. It's really your project. I came in late, so I'd rather find something of my own."
Luke nodded his head toward Bender.
"What he said."
I looked at Marvin, who shrugged and looked around the table.
"I'm a little more invested, I guess, because I came in earlier."
With a nod to Bender.
And let's face it, it's not a forever decision. I can hang around here for a few years or a few centuries. Marvin got a faraway look in his face. We really are immortal, aren't we? He shook himself and continued. Anyway, yeah, I'll hang around for a while. Maybe when we get a new batch of bobs raised, I'll reconsider. Marvin leaned back in his chair and put his hands behind his head. I nodded. Okay, guys, thanks. I'll adjust plans accordingly. Luke and Bender nodded, and their avatars disappeared. We cranked our frame rates back to normal and turned back to the feeds from the colony. 38. Riker, November 2158, Sol. I disconnected the UN meeting video with a sigh. The day's session had been pretty routine, which meant something just below a bunch of cats fighting over a fish. The announcement that the Spitz would be getting the third ship was met with the expected level of vitriol. Part of the problem was that Spitsbergen wasn't expected to be a viable location by the time the Spitz left, so no one would be able to take over the vacated premises. It was a waste of time to point out that that meant the Spitz would die if they didn't leave. This world was a lot harsher than the one I grew up in. In addition, the release of the Svalbard Trust contents didn't benefit anyone unless they were on a colony ship, so to most groups it was a decision with no upside. There had also been discussion of the latest threats from some group calling itself Vehement. I made a mental note to talk to the colonel about them. If I ever got that far, I looked at my call list. Unbelievable. For some reason, even if I didn't participate in a session, everyone felt the need to call me afterwards. I wish I could say it was nice to be popular. And naturally, the first caller was my favorite faith minister. I grimaced and briefly considered letting Guppy take him, but I knew I'd just be putting it off. However, I could make him wait. Ignoring the list, I made a call to Butterworth. We exchanged the minimum pleasantries, then I asked him about this latest batch of loonies.
Yes. Stands for Voluntary Extinction of Human Existence means Earth's Natural Transformation, or something close to that. I've heard several variations, including one or two that are obscene. Their stance is that humans have had their chance, and we should just let ourselves die off.
Except they're threatening to use guerrilla tactics to get their way. Where does voluntary fit into that? Butterworth waved a hand dismissively.
I believe they expect you to voluntarily go along with them in order to avoid violence. Such fringe groups have a much harder time of it these days, but somehow they still manage to cause the occasional bit of damage. I think they were expecting to ultimately get their way until you showed up on the scene. Now they've started to escalate the rhetoric.
Wonderful. I remember something vaguely similar from when I was alive, but that one was voluntary, in practice as well as in name. So, where does this group operate out of?
No idea, the colonel shrugged. Pronouncements are anonymized. Incidents appear to be random in location except for being opportunistic. Their manifesto essentially says that we can voluntarily stop breeding or they will help us along the path.
I rubbed my forehead. People's capacity for turning dogmatic stupidity into political movements never ceased to amaze me. We've knocked off 99.9% of the human race, and somehow the crazies still manage to survive. It just defies the odds. The colonel laughed, and we said our goodbyes. Well, so much for delaying tactics. I was going to have to deal with Cranston. With a theatrical sigh, I connected the call.
Good afternoon, Minister. What can I do for you?
Minister Cranston smiled into the camera, or showed his teeth anyway. I had no illusions about his friendliness.
Good day, Riker. I believe I have someone here that you'd like to talk to.
He reached forward and adjusted the camera at his end, bringing a young woman into the frame. She smiled shyly and said,
Good afternoon, Mr. Johansson. My name is Julia Hendricks.
I was stunned, totally frozen. I wouldn't say she was the spitting image of Andrea, but if this woman wasn't related to my sister, it would be a miracle of coincidence. A small part of my mind knew that Minister Cranston had done this deliberately to manipulate me, but I didn't care. Finally, after almost a quarter second of silence, I found my voice. Hi, Julia.
I'm assuming we're related? She nodded, quick, jerky movements. She seemed very nervous, but whether because of me or because of the minister, I couldn't say. I had little doubt that the minister had given her very specific instructions, accompanied by threats. After a moment, she found her voice.
Yes, I'm Andrea Johansson's 3x great-granddaughter. I just found this out myself.
She gave a small, aborted glance in the minister's direction. The message was loud and clear. I smiled back at her, trying for as much warmth as I could. So how many collateral descendants do I have? I think this question put Julia on more familiar ground.
More than 20 currently alive that I know of, Mr. Johansson. Riker.
She looked down, embarrassed. It's okay, Julia. I held up a hand. I'm not really your great-great-great-granduncle. I'm just his memories. And I don't go by Bob anymore, so that's out. Might as well just call me Riker, like everyone else does. Almost everyone. I gave Minister Cranston a hard glance. Or William, or even Will. I don't expect you to really care about me, although I'm guessing Minister Cranston expects me to care about you and your relatives. I tilted my head sideways, a minimal shrug. And he's right. But that's not the same as saying I'll bend the rules. Minister Cranston leaned fully into frame.
We're all adults, Mr. Riker, and we all know I have ulterior motives, just as all the other delegates do. Nevertheless, you have relatives here, and you will be able to talk to them whenever you want without interference. I'll leave you to it.
And with that, he got up and left the office. Of course they could still monitor the conversation, but it was a nice touch. Julia and I looked at each other in shock for a moment. Then we both started to speak at the same time. The log says we talked for 3 hours, but it felt like no time at all.
39. Bob, October 2165, Delta Eridani. I sat back in my chair, coffee in hand, and watched the fusion signatures of Luke and Bender as they accelerated out of the Delta Eridani system. Picking destination systems for them had been difficult and contentious. There were a lot of M and K class stars relatively close to this system. The problem with those is that they tended to be small and dim, with comfort zones very close to the star. A couple of the candidates were what you'd call marginal, and there was some argument about whether we should even bother with them. In the end, it was up to Luke and Bender. Luke was heading for Kappa Ceti, a G5 EV star just a touch smaller than Sol. Bender had selected Gamma Leporis A, an F6V star, a bit bigger and brighter than Sol. Bender was going to have a long trip. His target was more than 16 light-years away, but hey, we're immortal. Report went off to Bill all right?
Affirmative. The space station is fully operational. AMI controller is now in charge. The report was handed off for transmission.
I tented my fingers and drummed them together.
Excellent.
Marvin sat across the desk, nursing a coffee of his own. I watched that for a second, frowned, and asked,
Hey, which of us is supplying the VR for your coffee? You or me?
Marvin rolled his eyes.
Jeez, way to break the spell. To answer your question, I am. You're just supporting the visuals at your end. Crying out loud, we all invented this stuff.
Sure, but we've also all been hacking away at it and sharing mods. I'd have to really sit down and go over the code to understand what it's doing nowadays. He said, then changed the subject.
Did you notice with Luke and Bender that they really weren't carbon copies?
Yeah, but we had that discussion with Bill way back about Milo and Mario, remember? Each of us is a bit different. Differences in hardware, quantum effects.
Marvin waved his hand dismissively. Invoking quantum effects is just hand-waving. Just means we don't know. I wonder if, as we get older and accumulate memories, we're getting too complex for a backup to contain everything. The backup is a digital attempt to save an analog phenomenon. It may simply be too granular.
I stared into space. Interesting thought. You know, I still have the backup I made you from.
Maybe I should use that for the next batch of Bob's and bring them up to date the old-fashioned way.
Whiskey with a little sugar and bitters around the lip of the glass?
I put my hand vertically in front of my nose. Knack, knack, knack. No, funny boy. Verbally. Marvin grinned at me, then reached forward and poked one of the video feeds. It expanded to full size. Things had settled down in the colony. In all, over 40 Deltans had died in the gorilloid attack. Several who were injured but not killed were maimed for life. I'd finally gotten to see how the Deltans handled their dead. They did indeed have a ceremony, and they buried their dead. They also mourned them, every bit as heart-wrenching as any human. I'd had to turn away from the video for most of that. The colony had been cleaned up, and most of the gorilloid carcasses were gone. Archimedes had found the remains of the Buster drone, not that it would do him much good. All that was really left were the steel caps at either end. Most of the rest of it had been shredded and scattered. But Archimedes had discovered that the two 20-pound items could be used as a hammer or an anvil. They seemed to be able to take any punishment he threw at them. Well, on a scale of 0 to 10 for cultural contamination, I'd rate that as a 1.5, so screw it. Arnold kept the axe. No one wanted to try to take it away, and anyway, Arnold was willing to do any chopping that anyone needed. He seemed to enjoy the action. He was very good at it, and the requester didn't have to do any work. Very much a win-win.
We'd done enough language analysis that we could now follow conversations and maybe even speak intelligibly.
I massaged the phonemes in my speech routine to produce a generic Deltan voice and tried the result on Marvin with a couple of phrases. He approved of the result. I did some design changes to the exploration drone to add a speaker system and sent an order to the auto factory to build a couple. If the Deltans didn't decide to head back to the Flint site on their own, I was prepared to prompt them directly. If that meant being the great sky god, so be it.
40. Linus. April 2165, Epsilon Indi.
It took 14.5 years to get to Epsilon Indi. Funny, I still sort of thought in terms of human timescales, so there was this feeling that I just used up a major part of my life. Of course, intellectually, that wasn't true. First, I'd only experienced a little over 3 years of personal time thanks to Einstein and time dilation. Second, we're immortal. I just don't think we've internalized that fact yet. I had gone off on my own rather than wait for Bill to build another cohort, and I sure as hell wasn't going to team up with either of the Looney Brothers. I don't know what the deal was with Calvin and Goku. In theory, they're me, but I'm pretty sure I'm not that obnoxious. I hope. Anyway, for all their constant fighting, they seemed to be connected somehow. And I guess they knew it since they took off together. Meanwhile, I was here. At Epsilon Indi, 14 light-years from Epsilon Eridani, where Bill was set up, but only 11 light-years from Earth. That made it a reasonable, if not a prime, target for probes. As a K-type star, it was cooler and smaller than Sol, and livable planets would be correspondingly closer to the star and more likely to be tidally locked. Still, it's not like there was a ton of choice in the stellar neighborhood. When I'd been a kid, watching Star Trek and Star Wars and Stargate and all the other science fiction shows, it seemed like every planet was M-class and every star was yellow. And everyone spoke English. Sadly, turns out old Sol is exceptional. Most of the stars in the sky are either smaller or stupid big, which means pretty poor pickings for habitable planets. I was cautious coming into the system. It was possible that one of the other nations had chosen this system as a destination. Medeiros was a known factor, but we had no idea what the others would be like. We could probably rule out friendly, but there was a lot of range between harsh words and firing missiles. I coasted in with a couple of scouts ahead of me to scope out the situation. While I waited, I continued to work on my VR. I had decided on domed floating cities in the atmosphere of Saturn. The rings arched across the sky and giant clouds bloomed up to incredible heights. Below, breaks in the cloud layers gave line of sight for hundreds of kilometers into the depths of the atmosphere, and the cloudscape disappeared gradually into a horizon almost infinitely far away.
I stood in my rooftop garden and looked over the city from my vantage point. Hey, my VR, I can be the rich guy with the penthouse.
Structures detected.
I looked up. Guppy had appeared out of nowhere with that announcement. I don't think he approved of my VR for some reason, because he always seemed to be breaking consistency. What have we got? Guppy pulled up a visual. It was at extreme range for our optical telescope, so all I could really tell was that it was artificial.
One scout is approaching the structure for a closer investigation.
Good. When he's close enough, take a sonar scan. Send me the results. Meanwhile, let's move cautiously.
Aye. We have received a voice transmission from the structure.
That was interesting. I think a message from Medeiros would have been more cylindrical and explodey in nature. Play it back, please. Guppy pulled up the audio file.
Piss off, mate.
My eyes opened wide and I choked off a guffaw. Well, Guppy, I think we found the Australian probe, which officially didn't exist, if I remember right. I tried to get my grin under control. Okay, let's open a channel, or whatever it is we do to talk. At Guppy's nod, I addressed the structure. Hi, I guess you were the Australian probe. Pretty sure that isn't a Chinese accent, anyway. This is Linus Johansson of the Faith Ship Heaven 8. To whom am I speaking?
I said rack off.
Nope. I don't seem to be moving. Want to try again? There was a short delay, then...
This is Emperor Meng of the Intergalactic Jalapeno Empire. You're in sovereign space. Last chance. On your bike and piss off.
The guy was either not being serious or he was seriously nuts. Visuals of the structure were coming in with a little more detail now. It appeared to be a haphazard collection of connected structures and geometrical shapes. Kind of a Salvador Dali on drugs version of NASA's International Space Station. I wondered if he actually had colonists in there. Okay, Your Highness. Consider me an ambassador from the Bobbian Federation. The statement was met with dead silence. However, the conversation, if it could be called that, had given my scouts time to get close enough for a sudar sweep. Guppy popped the scan results up in front of me. No life on board. Not even any on board, really. The interior was open to vacuum, and a lot of the structures were missing entire walls. There was no logical order to this thing. He finally broke his silence.
Are you alone? I'm alone.
Well, he was volunteering information now. That was good. I'm here with you, Your Highness. That's not alone, right?
Who's Your Highness, and who are you?
Uh-oh, whack job, definitely. Still, that's better. At least he's not an emperor anymore. Maybe he's going to become more lucid. What's your name?
Henry Roberts. I was selected to represent Australia in the race to populate the stars. I've been captured by the Jalapeno Empire, and I'm being tortured for our secrets. And we're back to whack job.
Guppy, keep doing scans. I want to identify the working parts of the, palace. See if the probe is in there somewhere. I turned my attention back to Henry. Tell me about yourself, Henry. How were you selected? There was a silence, then a sob.
I'm a sailor. I was a sailor. I used to do solo trips. The government offered me the opportunity because they figured I'd be perfect for the job. I don't like being around people, you know.
There was another sob.
I miss sailing. I miss people.
I have identified the major probe subsystems. Replicant core, fusion reactor, auto factory systems. The probe is partly disassembled and totally integrated into the structure.
Thanks, Guppy. Load the railgun, would you? Something appropriate for the reactor control system, if you can target that. Again, I address the other replicant. How long have you been here, Henry?
Centuries. They're fish. They won't let me go. They keep torturing me. They demand attention. They make me build more rooms.
I remembered back to discussions with Dr. Landers about replicants going psychotic. I wasn't an expert on the field, being more of an engineering type, but this had a definite flavor of psycho. There certainly wasn't any they around anywhere that I could see. Henry, are you able to sail? Do you have a body? Do you see yourself?
What? No, I'm a space probe. The government took that away. I can't feel myself. I miss sailing.
Wow, sensory deprivation for years and years. He probably didn't have the technical know-how to build a VR. I remembered back to the beginning of the trip outbound from Seoul before I'd constructed the VR. Before Bob had constructed the VR, I guess. But there'd been that feeling of disconnectedness. Decades of that? No thanks. Henry, I could give you that back. There's a way for you to sail again. You just need to...